Hi, this is Brian Walker from Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, and you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome to all you folks out there who are mad about comics. This is Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. And this is your bonus episode of Comic Book Central this week. You're all on the bonus plan. We're getting extra episodes this week. This Saturday, May 5th, it's not only Free Comic Book Day, but if you happen to be anywhere in the Columbus, Ohio area, you will be able to check out an amazing art exhibit at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. I am so looking forward to this. Saturday, May 5th, that's the opening reception of the Mad Magazine exhibit at the Billy Ireland called Artistically Mad, Seven Decades of Satire. Mad megastar artist Sergio Aragonés, he's going to be there, as will collectors Glenn Bray and Grant Geisman, they'll be there, and Mad editor Bill Morrison, he will be there as well. The opening reception is free and open to the public. The exhibit runs through October 21st. One other guest that's going to be at that opening reception on May 5th is my special guest today. Today I'm going to be sitting down with the curator of the Mad exhibit, Brian Walker. We're going to be talking not only about what visitors to the Billy Ireland Museum are going to see at the Mad exhibit, we're going to be chatting about the history of Mad Magazine, and we will take a look back at the life and legacy of Brian's father, legendary cartoonist Mort Walker, creator of Beetle Bailey, High and Lois. Mort Walker, of course, passed away at the age of 94 this past January. Brian and his brothers have kept his cartoon creations and legacy alive and well over the years, so lots to talk about with Brian today. By the way, links to the sites for the cartoons and the Mad exhibit, all these links, they're going to be in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. and blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. So you can get a lot more information out there by clicking those links. Good show on tap for today. Happy Star Wars Day if you're listening on May the 4th. May the 4th be with you. Happy Free Comic Book Day if it's Saturday and you're listening to it. Comics and culture, that's what's on tap for today. Before we go mad, check this out. Then I'll be right back to talk tunes, cartoons that is, and comics with Brian Walker. Brian was born and raised in Connecticut, the son of famous cartoonist Mort Walker. Now, Mort was creator of Beetle Bailey and High and Lois, staples of the Sunday Funnies since the 1950s. Brian and his brothers ultimately worked on the strips with their father, and that's not the only comics cred on Brian's resume. He graduated from Tufts University. Along with his father, he founded the Museum of Cartoon Art, served as the director of the International Museum of Cartoon Art, and he served as the curator for more than 70 cartoon exhibitions. He taught cartoon history at the School of Visual Arts. He was the editor-in-chief of Collector Showcase magazine. He has written, edited, contributed to more than three dozen cartoon-related books, including the comics before 1945 and the companion volume, The Comics Since 1945. Joining me now to go a little mad is the curator of the Mad Magazine exhibit at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. He is also a cartoonist. He's a writer. A big welcome to Brian Walker. Brian, thank you so much for joining me today on Comic Book Central.
Well, it was nice talking to you.
Nice to have you here. First, let me say on behalf of myself and the listeners out there, our sincere condolences on the loss of your father earlier this year. My goodness, what a career.
Yeah, great run, 94 years old. Was still working on the strip right up to the end, and even played a little golf in November. But,
wow.
You know, he, it's really had quite a remarkable life in just not only creating these iconic comic strips, but starting the Museum of Cartoon Art and serving as president of the National Cartoonist Society and it was really kind of I got so many calls and emails and condolences that it was just like a wave that was just overwhelming, really.
It's, I don't know how you process it. I mean, just being his son, but for us, It's just this whole world. I mean, we think about our childhood. We think about Beetle Bailey. We think about, you know, no matter what era you're in, that was part of your life. It was just always there. It's one of those things. It's kind of like The Simpsons now almost. It's just like there's some point it's going to be like it's always been there. But as his son, can you like kind of take us into that world? Like, when did you first know about cartooning and what dad did for a living? And when did that all start to gel for you?
Well, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, original cartoons hanging in the walls of our den, and guys that work with my father, like Jerry Dumas, would come over to work, and Dick Brown, and all of his cartoonist buddies. And I just thought that was normal, you know. And at some point, I grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which is, you know, sort of like Mad Men territory, where most of the dads went off to Manhattan to work, and they went on business trips. And I went to my friend's house, and I said, where's your dad? You know, isn't he here when you get home from school? You know, he said, no, he works in Manhattan, you know. And I just felt sorry for this kid that his father wasn't around all the time. But interesting story about Mad magazines, you know, when I was born in 52, which is when Mad started, and, you know, most of my friends, the parents wouldn't let that Mad magazine in the house.
Yeah.
But my father actually had a subscription. My brother and I would sneak into his studio and, like, pilfer his Mad magazines. And I remember him coming into our room once and saying, who stole all my Mad magazines?
Was he mad or was he proud?
No, he was frustrated. He wanted to, you know, wanted to look at him. And
so he, like, you were horning in on his magazines. It wasn't like he was upset that you were, like, seeing all this, like, sort of, you know, adulting humor and jokes and, you know.
He was, you know, I mean, he was friends with some of the artists, really, you know, I mean, so.
He was just ticked off you were touching his stuff.
Right, yeah. We had them stashed under our beds and, you know, probably took all of them, really, you know, and it was like.
That's funny. When did you get a sense that, dad's earning a living doing this. Maybe I could do this. I could just, you know, be a cartoonist. When did you get a sense of that? You know, was art school and all these, like, take us through that, your sort of formative years into your world of cartooning.
I think because people knew who my father was, I was always the kid that got asked to do the poster for the school dance or draw a cartoon for the newspaper or something like that. But of course I grew up in the 60s. So it was, you know, I was very rebellious and, you know, got kicked out of the house a few times and had big arguments with my father about Vietnam. And, so it wasn't part of my plan to, you know, follow in his footsteps or work in the family business or anything like that.
Okay.
And it was really, I did some serious wandering around the world. I mean, I traveled through Africa when I was about 20, and I finally came back after college and was painting houses like a lot of college kids did back in those days. This was 1974, and my father said, I'm going to rent this mansion around the corner to start a cartoon museum, and think you could get some of your buddies to clean it up and put a fresh coat of paint on the walls. And next thing I knew, I was putting up exhibits, and I worked there for 18 years.
Wow.
Until the museum moved to Florida, and I've stayed connected with it all these years. I did exhibits for them in Florida, and eventually, that collection from the Cartoon Museum ended up at the Billy Ireland. And so that's kind of why I'm curating exhibits there even to this day, really.
Okay, you took me right into it. And I was curious as to the genesis of this, because for those that aren't familiar with it, I think it originally started as the Museum of Cartoon Art, I think when your dad founded it, and then it became the International Museum of Cartoon Art. Is that correct?
Right. We were the Museum of Cartoon Art in Greenwich, Connecticut, which was just around the corner from my family home.
Okay.
And then we moved to Westchester County. And then in 92, they moved it to Florida, built a new building, and it reopened down there as the International Museum of Cartoon Art.
What made him think of that, of doing something like that? And what were some of how did it look to begin with? Like, what were some of the things that were in there? And like, why did your dad think like, hey, this needs to be a thing?
Well, I think that, you know, of course, he grew up loving cartoons. I mean, he wrote away like when he was a kid back in the 1930s and got original strips from famous cartoonists and just always loved cartooning. It's, you know, I have a picture of him when he's like, you know, 13 years old and he's sitting at his drawing board with his pen in his hand. He's got originals on the wall. I mean, he always knew that's what he wanted to do as far back as he can remember.
That wasn't you, right?
No. And I think some of the cartoonists heard about what was going on, and particularly in Europe. I mean, they got invited to a cartoon museum in Rapallo, Italy, I think, at one point. This was probably back in the 60s.
Okay.
There was a cartoon exhibit at the Louvre in Paris. And they were saying, why isn't there something like that in this country? We're the ones that invented it, which isn't exactly true. And so the National Cartoonist Society had kind of a committee, and they went to Washington, and every time it would look like it was going someplace, it would fall through, and there was, you know, so he just kind of took the bull by the horns, and he got a grant from the Hearst Foundation and basically just started it himself with some friends. A cartoonist named Jack Tippett was the first director, and I worked there right from the beginning.
Okay.
And we just kind of made it up as we went along. I had no background, no experience in museums. I'd never worked in a gallery, nothing, you know. We had no idea what we were doing. And maybe a good thing, because I think a cartoon museum is a unique thing. It's not exactly an art museum. It's not exactly a library. I think the Billy Ireland is sort of finally figured it out. You know, I think it's a wonderful institution that is part museum, part library. And which is what a cartoon, you know, institution like that should be, because cartoons are both, literature and graphic arts.
Writer and artist.
Together.
Yeah, writer and artist. Look, I've said this for so long. I mean, it's... And you hit on something there I want to ask you about, because I kind of side with your dad in that, like, this is an American art form. This, like, to me, this is, I just saw the Superman exhibit, and they had the 1940 Superman painting. I'm like, that's our Picasso. That's my Picasso,
yeah,
sitting right there. I kind of side with your dad on that. But you mentioned, like, this wasn't, like, we didn't originate this. Can you expand on that a little bit? And I still might not agree with you, just because,
right,
I love comic books.
Well, it's interesting you brought up Picasso, because, you know, when we started the Cartoon Museum, and it really was the first institution completely devoted to collecting and preserving cartoon art. And I remember in the original location, people would come in and say, why a cartoon museum? I mean, you can read this stuff in the newspapers or comic books. Why do you need a museum for it? You know, and my father would say, because, you know, you wouldn't just look at a picture of the Mona Lisa in a book. You want to go see the real thing, you know. And, you know, I've continued, even after the museum closed down, I've continued doing exhibitions at other museums. And just this past fall, I did a major George Harriman Crazy Cat exhibit for the Reina Sofia Museum in Madrid, Spain, where Picasso's Guernica is. So you go in this room, and there's Guernica, which is like this massive, takes up an entire room, you know. And this is, the Mona Lisa of modern art, really. There's people standing there, like 100 people staring at it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you go out down the hall and around the corner and through another door, and there were 5 galleries of George Harriman Crazy Cat artwork. And I was the curator of that show, and it was a huge honor to be, you know, to have the opportunity to do that. And I feel like it's been this long, slow climb to respectability. And I think in this country, we're still far away from the goal, is to, you know, like, why doesn't the Museum of Modern Art have an exhibit like that?
Yeah.
Or the Whitney, or... I worked on this exhibit called Masters of American Comics, which came close to that, you know, where we were in two museums in L.A. And in Milwaukee and in New York. It was a two-year touring exhibit. It got a lot of, you know, serious attention. And but, you know, it was always my father's goal for people to sort of have developed a serious appreciation for comic art and the talent of the artist and what it takes. And the uniqueness of it isn't fine art, and it isn't literature. It's something else completely different. And in Europe, they don't seem to ask that question, is it art? You know, that doesn't seem to really concern them. They just take it for granted that it's just another art form, just like painting and sculpture and photography and film and everything else.
But when you get into it, I mean, you're absolutely right. When you get into it and look at these things, I think it hits on so many levels. Even when you think about political cartoons and you think about what we're going to talk about, Mad Magazine, satire, commenting on events of the day, all these things. I think it just hits on so many levels. And I think that's why when you talked about including the writers and you need to have the books and you need to read the stories and find out what they're commenting on, it's almost like a time capsule into not only American culture, but just culture in general.
Right. Yeah, there was Colin Murphy, who is a writer who just recently wrote a book called Cartoon County, which is about the part of Connecticut that both Colin and I grew up in, where all our fathers were these cartoonists and they were all friends with each other, and it was this kind of unique time. And it got a lot of really good reviews and coverage and stuff. And when my father passed away, Colin did a little guest editorial for the New York Times about Mort Walker, historian, you know, and about how my, you know, everybody thinks of my father as an entertainer, as a cartoonist and everything, but he also had this serious side where he really wanted to make people understand that cartoons tell history, tell the history of the United States. They tell, like through political cartoons or comic strips, what people were wearing and saying and thinking about and laughing at. And it's almost like you can go back in time by reading some of this historical material.
I've said, if you pick up Mad magazines from the 60s and 70s, or if you tune into, like, go back and watch some episodes of Laugh-In on YouTube, I mean, if you want to understand history, that's a great way to dive into it.
Yeah,
it's amazing. And you talk, well, before we get to Mad Magazine and the Billy Idol, I just want to mention, you and your brother had taken over, Beetle Bailey and High and Lois. You said your dad was working on the cartoons up until his passing. Could you just sort of give us that little area? Because these cartoons are still going strong. They're still online. We can still read them. Can you just sort of bring us up to date on your father's creations and the family impact on them?
Well, you know, my brother and I, you know, sometimes my father would say, I got my kids working for me. You know, we're in our 60s now. So we've been doing this for a long time. I mean, I started working on the comic strips after I started working at the museum. It was the early 1980s.
I was going to say 84, 83. Yeah, since 84,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And that's about when I started working. And my brother is a couple years older, and he actually did comic books and stuff before that. You know, he did like a Sergeant Snorkel comic book. And so he's been doing it even longer, probably closer to 40 years or something. And remember at the time, you know, one of the first things, he was having some complaints about Miss Buxley, you know, the character, the secretary in Beetle Bailey. He said, well, you're a liberated guy. You try writing for this, you know, get me out of hot water. And one of the things I noticed, so that was one of my first assignments. And I noticed
writing for Miss Buxley. You were, that was, oh, okay.
But one thing I noticed is that she hardly ever said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote some gags. Gags is what we call them.
Give her some dialogue,
The idea. And give her like a comebacker. Let her get the last laugh occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
Because she truly was a sex object in the beginning. And then with High and Lois, you know, I had just gotten married. I hadn't even had kids yet. And he said, no, you guys are young parents. You know, my staff is getting old. Our kids are all grown up. He said, why don't you take this over? So So I pretty much took over High and Lois in the mid-'80s and do most of the writing for it and the editing. And actually, I was thinking recently, I think I've probably written High and Lois longer than my father did.
Oh, wow. Wow.
He started in 54, and he went up to about 86.
But such a cool concept from him, too, because this was a spinoff of Beetle Bailey, right? It's just like we think about like All in the Family and all of its spinoffs, and we think cartoons do that, too. Like Beetle Lois's Beetle's sister?
Right.
Okay.
So, when Beetle Bailey started in 1950, he was a college student, and the strip was going nowhere. So the Korean War started, and out of desperation, my father had him enlist. And, you know, the strip started doing better. And then when the Korean War was over, about 54, he said, oh, no, nobody's going to like the military theme now. The war's over, so maybe I'll take Beetle and put him back in civilian life. And he went to go visit his sister, Lois. And all his readers, no, we like Sarge and General Halftrack. Put him back in the Army. So with the encouragement of his editor, King Features, he decided to start a second strip. Yeah. And he needed help, so he basically found Dick Brown at that point, who was working for an advertising agency, and the rest is history.
That's great. I love that. I love that whole concept of it. What did you learn from your father about telling a story in four panels?
Well, I learned a lot. You know, it's one of my friends, when my father passed away, said, you know, you've been really fortunate to have worked with your father for most of your career, you know, your post-college. I said, that's true. You know, we all work separately in our own studios, but we have these monthly meetings for each strip. And, you know, I just, in the beginning, I really paid a lot of attention to, like, what he thought was funny and why that didn't work. And Beetle would never say that. And I mean, you really have to get your head inside the characters and in the environment that the strip, you know, the Camp Swampy, like you almost feel like it's real. You know, you walk in those through those barracks and driving in those Jeeps and stuff like that. Because it has to be believable, even though it's completely ridiculous, you know. I mean, of course, Army barracks hasn't looked like that probably since the First World War, you know?
right.
And they're still driving around in these Jeeps that don't look anything at all like what they have now. So one of my favorite quotes, one time a reporter asked Dick Brown about his strip Hagar the Horrible. And he said, do you do a lot of research about Vikings and you know, the costumes and the boats and... And Dick was like, of course not. Hagar is not a strip about a Viking. It's a strip about a daydream of a Viking. And that's really true with any strip, really. You know, it's not, I mean, you know, Blondie is not really like a real
You
married
just went
couple.
Exactly where I thought you were going to go. Yeah. I know. It's the right. Running late for work. It's the making the sandwich. It's the sleeping on the couch. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's somebody's fantasy of what maybe married life probably never was. It could have been, or people wished it could have been. The same with Archie, you know. I mean, you know, was there ever really a high school like that, you know? And it kind of grates on me sometimes when I see them trying to update it, you know, make it more relevant and current. You know,
I was curious how you were going to go like on some of the newer cartoons, because the newer comic books, or even like Riverdale, like TV shows. So you're kind of like, not so much.
Yeah. So, you know, we've done that not so much with Beetle Bailey. We haven't really modernized it too much, but with High and Lois, it's a family strip and it's reality based and stuff. So we can't really ignore progress, you know, where people are going to say, why are they still driving around in this big old gigantic station wagon with wood paneling on the side of it, you know? So we've updated the cars, and of course, you know, Chip has the kids have cell phones, and Chip plays in a band, and, you know, stuff like that. So all those sort of trappings of family life, things change, you know? The clothing has changed a little bit, you know? But essentially, at the core of it, it's still about a family. It's still about a mother and a father and a teenager and two twins and a little baby and a dog and next-door neighbor and all the rest of it. That part of it really hasn't changed that much. you know, and to try to make it more relevant. I mean, you know, people are always saying, "How? Why didn't you send Chip over to Iraq or something? You know,
oh my
or
goodness.
Afghanistan?" So that would really be hilarious, you know. And they maybe get
there's comedy
wounded over there, and he comes back with the, you know, traumatic post-traumatic syndrome.
Okay, but isn't that like? But isn't that the reason we love cartoons and cartoon strips or comic strips, however you want to refer to them? Isn't that that we like sort of the break from reality? And I think you even mentioned it. It's sort of our idealized reality.
Yeah, it's kind of like an oasis or something that you can go to and you know, replenish your your calmness or something. You know?
Family Circus, I mean, it's always going to be not me and the little ghost, not me. Marmaduke is always going to be huge and knocking things over. I mean, I think we love that security. It's almost like a security blanket for us in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's challenging sometimes because we're always torn because, you know, it's like you always want to think of something new and fresh, something that hasn't been done before. You don't want to repeat yourself over and over again. And, you know, there are those, you know, online grousers that say, Abito Bailey hasn't been funny in years and it's the same joke over and over again. And when it, you know, there's these legacy strips, why don't they kill them off and get rid of them and stuff? But then there's inevitably like, oh, we love Trixie in the Sunbeam, you know, and she's sitting in the Sunbeam with a dog and, you know, do more of that. And I tell you, those are some of the hardest gags to write, because it's like, how many different ways can you do the Sunbeam? You know, I mean, you know, we've done it, you know, it's just, they're never the funniest gags, but, you know, it's like with Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football.
Yes.
Kicking the football, and he would do that every year, essentially the same gag, and people love it.
I'm a huge nostalgia guy. I mean, I'm sitting here surrounded by the 70s pretty much, and you know, in my basement here. And it's just, speaking for me, I don't know how the rest of the listeners feel, but speaking for me, I love when you guys just sort of embrace this. That is a security blanket to know that's there. It's amazing stuff. Mad Magazine is nostalgia to me as well. Let's here's the bridge. Okay, I'm going to give you a trivia question. Trivia question / exhibit question. Are you ready for this?
Right.
Will we see some of your dad in the exhibit? And I want to refer to Mad Magazine issue number 89.
That's the one where, that's the one where the comic strips were like something or other. There's a whole bunch of those that they did, actually.
You got it.
There's
one where, you got it. I know. It's the title is Comic Strips They'd Really Like to Do.
Okay, and then it shows Beale's eyes or something.
Well, it's your dad did like something he always wanted to do, but it wasn't. You know, there's Charles Schultz. They sort of did this thing. It's the magazine itself has Frankenstein on the cover, Alfred E. Newman, of course. And your dad contributed to Mad Magazine in the strip that he'd really like to do, and it's got like a little blurb from him in there. I'm just curious. I didn't know if that was going to be if you were going to sneak that into the exhibit. Or possibly the Beetle Bailey cameo in the Dirty Dozen spoof, Dirtier by the Dozen.
Oh, no.
Okay. I didn't know if either of those were going to make an appearance here in Columbus or not.
Yeah. I mean, I try not to, you know,
all right,
promote our product through these, you know, scholarly efforts. But I probably could have stuck. I mean, for one thing, I don't know where the artwork is for some of that stuff.
You know?
It's pretty hard. Most of what the exhibit is about is
the original artwork. Right. Okay. I wasn't sure because I thought, well, if he's behind it, maybe there's some original artwork from that. So,
yeah.
No worries.
It was actually a Beetle Bailey strip where Alfred E. Newman made a guest cameo in Beetle Bailey.
Oh, in Beetle Bailey. Oh, the reverse. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
And I think it was like something like, what kind of a idiot is running this camp or something, and you see him through the window, and it's Alfred E. Newman. They ran, I think, they reprinted that in the letters page at Mad, and I have somewhere a nice letter, I think, from Jerry DeFuccio, thanking my father or something, I don't know.
This I love this idea. Okay, so for those that aren't familiar with the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, which they should be, give us, if you can, a little bit of the history of the museum. You mentioned that was the your father's museum was incorporated into it. Give us an idea of what somebody can expect there, and maybe just even outside of this Mad Magazine exhibit, what are some things that just regular visitors any time of the year can expect?
Well, you know, the Museum of Cartoon Art, where I worked on with my father, started in 1974, and I believe the Cartoon Research Library was started by Lucy Caswell. Originally, it was just a room full of Milton Caniff papers, and that goes back, I don't know, to the late 70s, early 80s or something. So we worked on numerous exhibits over the years that I worked on with Lucy, you know, collaborating, you know, helping out. But I think it's been, what, 3 or 4 years ago, they moved into this new renovated building.
It's amazing.
Which is really spectacular. And it sort of vaulted that, the research library, into, you know, university research library, which is what it was, and it was one of the better ones and the more established, into really a center for cartoon art. And, you know, like worldwide, I mean, it's a significant institution, probably the leading institution in the field now. And it's just spectacular what's there. I mean, the galleries themselves are very beautifully designed, state-of-the-art. They're designed specifically to display cartoon art. They have these really great slant cases where the pages are angled so you can read them perfectly and everything. And these kind of sliding special drawer cabinets. And
there
sliding
you go. That's what I wanted you to hit on. Yep. Yeah. That to me was the most amazing thing. You can, it's almost like a comic book long box.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Where you can, go ahead. I'm sorry. I geek out on this. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we used to have in the Cartoon Museum, when we were in the castle in Rybrook, these flip racks that I think were, like, I bought them from this industrial display company. They were probably for, like, you know, wallpaper samples or something. But it was a way for us to expand so much. You know, it's what a lot of museums do now with these movable archives and stuff, where you can go in and they have walls that move back and forth and you can see stuff. And so, you know, all this is, you know, like if you go to Europe, they have a lot of the slant cases, and they were very, you know, they were sort of some of the first museums. The one in Angoulême was one of the first places I saw those, you know, where they display comic pages in that way. So, but in addition to the three galleries that they have there, there's, you know, classrooms and an auditorium and a reading room and you know, like a digital studio where they can photograph newspaper pages. And the storage space is like more the size of a football field or something. You know,
it's just ridiculous. Amazing. Yeah, it's ridiculous. We went there for the Calvin and Hobbes exhibit they had there, and it was, did you make it for that or not?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, actually.
Oh, so that was brilliant, even on its own. And then you're going through, and I'm pulling these drawers out, and I'm just sifting through the history of comic books.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. It's like original artwork from the history of comics. So it's right there. Everything's right there. Yeah. Okay, so Mad Magazine.
Go ahead.
Please do. Please do.
So when the museum moved from Florida, you know, my father was pretty frustrated that it didn't make it down there. I mean, they built like a $6 million building down there, but they just didn't get the support from the community that they needed in Boca Raton. And so we moved everything back up to in storage. And we, at one point, we were approached by a number of universities, including Yale, that wanted our collection. And, you know, we turned Yale down. We said, you know, we don't want to see this all just stashed away somewhere in a research library. We want it open to the public. And my father's dream was always to have, you know, public hours where people can come and view this stuff, like in a museum. And when Lucy came to us and said, well, we're building exactly that, you know, we're building not only a research library, but a place with regular public viewing hours. So it's going to be a museum and a library. And that was the clincher. And that's when we decided just to give them this, you know, couple hundred thousand pieces of artwork, which really expanded their collection. I mean, they've got other significant collections. I mean, you know, the International Museum collection is not the whole thing. But in terms of original art and everything, that really just really upped their ante at that point, you know. And so it's been very nice for me to stay involved. I mean, it's an honor to actually be able. This is the third exhibit I've done there. I did the opening show for them, and then right after the Calvin and Hobbes, I did one called King of the Comics, which is a history of King Features Syndicate, and then this one. And you know, there's more down the road.
Can you give us a hint?
I probably shouldn't.
Can you give us a genre?
Well, I know that they're
comedy, like just.
I know that they have some. I probably shouldn't say anything.
Fair enough. We don't want any spoilers.
I don't want to get myself in trouble.
Artistically, you're fine. I don't want to get you in trouble. Artistically, yeah. Mad, Seven Decades of Satire. This is what we're looking at. May 5th through the fall, right?
Right, through October.
This is huge. I'm a huge Mad magazine fan. How did this come about? Is this the impetus for this the fact that Mad magazine basically picked up from New York and moved to the West Coast and rebooted with Number One?
I think part of the motivation for the Billy Ireland is to do this show is that they have this collection by a collector that was donated by a collector named Mark Cohen, who has collected Mad magazine. He's passed away now. His widow, I think, is going to be there at the opening, Rosie McDaniel.
This is May 5th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he had this pretty big collection, and he actually used to have a traveling exhibit of a Mad magazine artwork that he toured around to small museums and places like that. So they've got this sort of core collection there at the Billy Ireland. And I think at some point early on, Jenny Robb asked me to send her a list of ideas for exhibits.
How did you get involved? Was it just because you were involved on other exhibits that, and because you're a huge comic book historian, I think I'm answering my own question here, but is that how you became involved?
Yeah, I mean, I can honestly say that when it comes to curating cartoon exhibits, I don't think anybody's has even done. I've done over 75 shows over the years.
Yeah. That question answered itself. I'm sorry.
Right. But also, you know, I'm on their board of advisors.
Okay.
I've worked, like I said, with Lucy Caswell for going back into the early 80s. I worked with her on the 50-year anniversary of Terry and the Pirates, Milton Caniff exhibit that we did at the Cartoon Museum in Rye Brook, and, you know, over the years. And so I have very close relationships with her and Jenny and Caitlin and everybody down there. I'm kind of like a visiting member of the family, I guess. I'm not part of the inner circle, but
I'm sure you're probably part of the inner circle. But look, you mentioned something like way early on that you I think you that it was a conflict with you and your dad over the Vietnam War. Were your sensibilities leaning more toward the Mad magazine sensibilities? Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think born in 52, when I was young, Mad magazine was very subversive. You know, the Mad magazine was telling us baby boomer kids, like, don't believe everything they're telling you, you know?
Yeah, that. But by the time you were old enough to know it, originally it was more of a comic booky kind of thing, right? And then
but it was satirizing, other comics.
Other comics.
And satirizing TV shows.
Right, and then it moved into more of, like, affairs of the world.
Right, social satire. Yeah. You know, I don't ever think it was overtly or stridently political, but, you know, certainly, you know, sort of thumbing their nose at the establishment.
There's a certain cover.
Right.
Okay. That issue number one reboot has mimicked.
Yeah. Oh, the finger. Yeah.
No, I think you're dead on. It just went against the establishment.
Yeah. But by the 60s, I was a hippie, you know. I was a card-carrying member.
I was going, yeah.
I mean, I was in the SDS. Civil disobedience, anti-war protests, the whole thing, you know. I think Mad Magazine certainly led directly to Zap Comics and Underground Comics. But I do think that Mad... You know, a lot of people say this, that, you know, that was a subversive element for that baby boomer generation. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it. And I'm probably not conscious of it at the time, but I look back on, you know, reading those magazines and that sort of satirical, thumbing your nose at the establishment, really, that's goes back to that, really.
Can we mention this opening reception? Free and open to the public. Boy, can you tell us who's going to be there?
You're
going to be there. You'll be there, right?
Yeah.
Sergio You're hanging Aragonis. Out, so you and I are going to be hanging out. So
yeah. Sergio Aragonis and Bill Morrison, the new editor.
Oh, give me a break, right?
And these two collectors that I really haven't gotten into that yet, but... What I was going to say before is when Jenny Robb called me up and said, well, we'd like you to curate the Mad show. And I said, oh, good, we're going to do that next, okay. And I said, well, let me go into the database and look and see what's in the Cohen collection for the Mad artwork. I came back, I said, it's a very representative collection. You know, all the major artists are represented there. But I'm afraid that you don't have the showstopper pieces here, you know, that people are going to go, oh, my God, where did you find that, you know? And I think we need to think, they like to usually have exhibits just to showcase their collection. And I said, I sort of talked Jenny, you know, like allowing them to borrow some artwork from a few lenders.
You had to go next level.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about over 70 years. I mean, we're talking about seven decades.
Yeah. And so what I did was I knew of these two collectors in L.A. that lived pretty close to each other. Glenn Bray, who has one of the most amazing collections of outsider art and comic art and everything from Mexican movie posters to Basil Wolverton and Karl Barks. And it's just an amazing collection. And he's got some of the really early, particularly Kurtzman stuff, including the concept cover for Mad Number One.
Oh, I was going to ask, are we going back? We're going back to the beginning, right?
That's one. That's number one. And it's a Kurtzman. It's not the finished cover. We've got the finished cover for,
right?
I believe it's Mad Number Six, I think. Okay. But this is Mad Number One, and it's a color piece. But it's just a rough design. It's really cool. And
that's mind blowing that you got that.
Yeah. And then we've got this other collector, Grant Geisman, who also has an amazing collection, but Glenn is really into the early period of Mad. Doesn't really care much about anything that happened after Kurtzman left. Where Grant has everything from all eras and lots of covers and like Norman Ringo and Kelly Freitas and guys that did the paintings for the covers, which are the most iconic things. I mean, you think of Mad, you think of Alfred E. Newman on the cover in full color, you know, on a slick
But these
cover.
Are originals.
Yeah, original paintings by Norman Mingo from like the 60s. So then we borrowed from those two lenders, and they're both also going to be at the opening. I'm going to do a talk with them, and they're going to tell some tales about collecting and where they found this stuff and what their favorite pieces are and everything like that. Grant actually did a book called Collectibly Mad, which is the Bible for mad collectors. So he knows everything. And then I also, in addition to the these sort of showstopper pieces on the wall, which are individual pieces, I wanted to show a little bit about the writing and the storytelling aspect of it. So we have three complete stories from three different eras. One is a Howdy Doody spoof from 1954 by Bill Elder. And that's seven pages, I think. Then we've got a Mort Drucker spoof of Saturday Night Fever from the 70s. That's an eight-page story.
He's hitting the sweet spot.
That's like one of Drucker's like best. That's peak Mort Drucker period. And then there's a current story by Tom Richmond, who is the successor to Mort Drucker from last year, and it's a parody of Stranger Things.
Wow.
And we have the cover of that issue, and then there's seven pages. So those are in those slant cases. So you can actually read a whole story beginning to end in originals, all originals.
I got to hit you with two questions here. Any reference to the records that used to be inserted in Mad Magazine?
Yeah, there's some reference to it. We have one of the, it's like a Mad Disco special edition.
Yep.
We have a cover design. We have the pencil sketch, the color rough, and the finished cover for that all framed together.
All right, that's covered.
But we'll, not the record.
Okay, but there's a reference.
I searched online, and I found that there's actually a CD called Mad Grooves.
Yep.
That's like a kind of a greatest hits collection of all the Mad songs.
Yep.
And I asked Caitlin, I said, if I get this, can we play it at the opening?
Can we play it, right.
It's pretty obnoxious, actually.
Well,
yeah, one of the songs.
Isn't that part of the vibe?
I guess I don't know. She never answered me. I think I found it. I might even have it somewhere in the attic, but I figured I'd just buy the thing on eBay or something.
Right.
But one of the songs is called "She Got a Nose Job." So that's the level of humor on these things. There is a disco
my super spectacular day.
That's one of the songs?
Yeah.
Huh.
And it's like every time you play it, when you play, like every time you drop the needle, it played a different version.
Oh, really?
If you can Google that between now and May 5th, if you can play Super Spectacular Day, I'll be a happy man.
Yeah. No, I'm going to go. I mean, last week I was just going down some rabbit hole, and I was reading about the music. And I said, oh, it'd be kind of cool to have some background music at the opening.
Oh. Will there be a superhero? Look, it's Comic Book Central, I got to ask you. Will there be a superhero section of the exhibit? I'm talking Super Duper Man, Batsman.
Yeah, we have a page from Super Duper Man.
That's all I need.
We also have a Wally Wood strip if cartoon characters got old. So it's like Superman, like, you know, like a really old Superman. That's like a comic strip.
You are making me a very happy individual here. You're not only making me a very happy individual, you're making me a proud citizen of Columbus, Ohio. You got a fun job, my friend. You got a fun job. I'm looking forward to meeting up with you. Okay, so for anybody out there right now that wants to go, okay, how can I find out more? How can I find out more about the world of Brian Walker? Where do we go?
We have a website, BeetleBailey.com. And highandlowest.com.
It's good stuff. And there's like, it doesn't it sort of indirectly lead to like Blondie and all like really cool cartoony stuff?
King Features has a web ring called Comics Kingdom.
Yeah.
So on that, you can get Zitz and Mutz and Blondie and Hagar and Beetle Bailey and High and Lowest. But you can also go just directly to BeetleBailey.com, we have our own website, which is part of the ring there. And there's bios of all the people that work on it there. There's today's strip on it. But the most important thing is I do a weekly post blog kind of post there on the history of Beetle Bailey. And I've been doing this for over three years now. So it's deep.
You're going back to 70s. I mean, you're hitting the historical highlights.
I showed somewhere in there is the first week of strips, back in the 50s. Yeah. I did a whole thing about all the products, collectibles, the movies that were made in the 60s. And the same thing with highandlowest.com. And what I, classic episodes, stories behind certain strips, photographs of the creators, everything you could possibly want. It's like an archive.
This is all free, right? I mean, you just click it and it's there. Oh my goodness.
Every week when I post something new there, I link it to our, we have Facebook pages also for High and Lois and Beetle Bailey.
No, I'm checking these new ones out. And I mean, your dad's legacy, it just lives on.
You're on BeetleBailey.com right now?
Yeah, I'm always on it. Look, I'm a nostalgia geek. I love this stuff. And the fact that you're continuing this tradition is amazing.
Do you have any of my books? Or?
I have to go get them. Full disclosure, I have to go get them.
Right. Because I have, two-volume history.
Now, let's name them here. The comics before 1945. Second volume, the comics since 1945. Is there anything else to cover? That's the history of comics. You want some more? Doonesbury and the Art of G.B. Trudeau. We got Doonesbury.
There's a book called The Comics, The Complete Collection, which is both of those two volumes in one budget volume.
Budget. If you want them both, if you want every comic since 1945, go get it, right?
It's like a 750-page book.
This is insane.
Like 5 years of my life I spent. That's my magnus opus or whatever you want to call it.
This is insane. I mean, it's such great stuff. And look, I love the fact that, I'm sticking to this. This is an American art form. You are part of making sure that it is celebrated. We've got the websites. We've got the exhibit. May 5th, you're going to be there.
Yep.
If you want to find out the history of comics, go meet him May 5th, Columbus, Ohio.
Yep. I'll be hanging out in the galleries there. And then we're going to do some talks. I mean, there's going to be Bill Morrison's going to talk, and I'm going to interview these two collectors, and Sergio's going to do a demonstration. There's going to be some questions and answers and stuff. So that'll be a program, and then there's going to be then the gallery opening, and there's going to be some food and drinks and... it'll be a good time.
You and I are going to knock back a glass of wine, aren't we?
Right. I'm looking forward to it.
That's going to happen. Brian, I'm looking forward to this. This is amazing. I'm always proud to be a citizen of Columbus. You just may be even more proud to be a citizen of Columbus. There's so many exhibits coming up. I think, can you give us a timeline as to the next one?
You know, the next exhibit I'm working on there is probably going to be 2020, I think.
Okay. All right. So you're working something up. Something really cool, though?
Oh, yeah. It's going to be epic.
Epic?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. This is epic. I can't even take this anymore. Thank you so much for bringing this to Columbus. Everybody come to Columbus. Brian, thank you so much for everything you do. Again, your dad's legacy lives on through you and through everything we're seeing. And thank you for joining me on the show today.
All right, nice talking comics with you.
And my thanks to Brian for giving us that preview of the Mad exhibit and for talking about his father, legendary cartoonist Mort Walker. So glad we got to chat about him and his life and legacy. Links to the latest adventures of his father's creations, Beetle Bailey, High and Lois, all the gang, all the cartoon characters that go along with him, as well as a link to all the information you're going to need about Artistically Mad, 7 Decades of Satire. Those can all be found in the show notes for this episode of my website, comicbookcentral.net and blogtalkradio.com/comicbookcentral. Thanks so much to Brian for stopping by today. So looking forward to this exhibit, and you've got until October. The exhibit runs through October, so go check it out. Plan your trip to Columbus, Ohio. It's going to be an amazing show. All right, kids, that is it for today. I am out of here, but not for long. No need to say what me worry about when the next episode of Comic Book Central is going to be, because next time on Comic Book Central, you are mere days away from my conversation with Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica. These days, she is menacing Team Flash as Amunet Black, a.k.a. Blacksmith on The Flash. The lovely and talented Katie Sackhoff, she's going to be here in the lair to talk about heroes, villains, sci-fi, comics, and bionics. Yes, we're going to get some bionics talk in there as well. That's what's headed your way on the next episode. Until then, have yourself a super spectacular day. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
It's a great, big, beautiful, wonderful, incredible, super spectacular day. And your heart is humming with good times coming. And you've got that happy feeling things are going your way. All the bells are ringing and a little bird singing while he sits on your windowsill. Saying, yes, sirree, I can surely see you'll plainly be most definitely a super spectacular day.
Until...
by 4:45, your relations arrive, and you greet Cousin Beth with terrible breath, and a fat bread of sire destroys your hi-fi, and your great-uncle Fred, who gets drunk in your bed, and your third cousin Vic was mentally sick, and his creepy friend Joe, and six more you don't know, and your short errand then is you shafted again. That it's not such a super spectacular day!